This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today on Fresh Air, we'd like to take some time to remember Philadelphia soul singer Teddy Pendergrass, who died Wednesday at age 59 of complications from colon cancer. Among his many hits was this one, Love TKO.
Looking back over my years, I guess I shed some tears. I told myself time and time again, this time I'm gonna win. But another fight, things ain't right, I'm losing again. Takes a fool to lose twice, start all over again. Think I better let it go. Looks like another love TKO. Oh, think I better let it go. What you think about it, girl? Oh, yeah. Try to take control of the love. Love to control me.
Teddy Pendergrass singing Love TKO. Pendergrass was one of the singers most identified with the Philly sound of the 1970s. He was the lead singer for Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, who had such hits as If You Don't Know Me By Now and The Love I Lost. When Pendergrass went solo, he became the first black male singer to record 5 consecutive multi-platinum albums. In 1982, he was in a car accident that left him a quadriplegic, but he slowly returned to singing and performing. Terry spoke with Teddy Pendergrass in 1998 after the publication of his autobiography, Truly Blessed. Teddy Pendergrass started singing in church as a child. When he was young, he says, he felt a calling to preach sermons. Terry asked him if he thought he'd grow up to be a preacher.
That is what I'm sure my mother thought I would do. And at the time, until I learned different, until I grew up, that's probably what I thought I would do as well. It's just that when you reach that ripe old age of 13, young kids, you know, they start to grow up and grow out, and they get, you know, get into their own thing and start doing their own thing. And I started getting involved in music and becoming interested in what we call secular music. And I saw, got a chance to see Jackie Wilson.
You said that's the experience that really changed you.
It changed my life around. So it was.
What was it about the Jackie Wilson performance?
Just a consummate performer to me. Just my image of him was just so huge. And he just controlled that stage. His audience was in the palm of his hands. And as I say in the book, you know, the ladies ran down to the front of the stage when they thought he had fell off to hurt himself. He had just rolled off intentionally and rolled off onto the floor. And to see the ladies run through the guardrails and just lay on top of him and appear to make mad passionate love to him in the middle of the floor at whatever time it was that morning, to me it was just, my jaws dropped. It was like, my God.
How can I do that?
Right. Yeah. That's what I wanted to.
Your mother worked in a club. She worked mm-hmm. in the kitchen of a club.
Mm-hmm.
And the club, well, I think Chubby Checker played there. Mm-hmm. I forget who else. But
lots of artists. Frankie Avalon, a whole lot of people.
Did that give you a sense, because I know you went with her sometimes, that performers could be accessible as well as being, like Jackie Wilson, as well as being as grand as that? There were performers who were kind of in reach.
Well, no. To me, it was just a huge thing. I mean, I was a child, 14 years old, meeting Chubby Checker. It was like, this was an opportunity of a lifetime.
Right.
It was huge to
right.
me. It just so happened to be, as I told my kid, the kid friends I had, my mom works at a club where this one goes, that one goes. We were off limits to that. We were black working in the kitchen. So, you know what I mean? It wasn't accessible to us.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
It
yeah.
was still out of, it was just a different, medium. One was a club where people sat and ate dinner, and those people that went in, they were white. For me, at the Uptown Theater, it was black kids. So that's where I went, because that's where people were that I could relate to. I felt very out of place at Skeola's. I felt loved, and I felt that I didn't feel like, because the color of my skin was a problem, because the family there treated all of us, my mother and me, like, just like we were like their kids or their grandkids, like they treated their grandkids. But we weren't allowed, wasn't allowed to sit out in the hall and sit out there and hang out with everybody else. Number one, because I was underage. Number two, because I never saw any black people out there. So my mother always kept me in the kitchen with her.
You first performed professionally with a small group that you met in Atlantic City. And then you moved on from that group to perform with the Cadillacs. And the Cadillacs' big hit had been Speedo, but I think this was a period when the Cadillacs had kind of franchised, so there were several there were several groups singing under the name the Cadillacs.
Right.
That's happening more and more with oldies acts now. I'm wondering if anybody ever got really angry with you when they realized that this wasn't necessarily the original
They didn't get mad at me because I was a drummer. I was just a guy in the band.
All right.
I could care less.
Did they get angry, though, at the singers?
I don't know. I could care less.
Really?
It was a job. Thank goodness I had ability to play as well as sing. So therefore, I could get a job playing until I could find a job singing.
So drums was secondary to you. What you really wanted to do is sing.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Melvin needed more backup singers, so he hired the group you were with, the Cadillacs, to be his new Blue Notes.
Mm-hmm.
So there you were, part of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
As the drummer.
Mm-hmm. How did you start singing, even though you were hired as the drummer? Because you became the lead singer.
Yeah, that was an interesting transition. How do I explain? As the drummer, I was the only musician that Harold hired from the band, which was the band for the Cadillacs. So he took the singers, and he liked the way I played so much, he offered me a job. At the time, I said, oh, okay, more money, just another job. You know, he didn't fire me. Great, fine. We began to realize that sometimes the group would be late. If they were late, the club owners would dock them. We would all make less money. So the band began to sing the songs that the group would sing if they were late in order to make sure and ensure that we got paid. So sometimes the Blue Notes would come in and hear us singing, and I'd be sitting on the drums playing and singing. So then they realized, oh, this guy can sing. And from there, just evolved.
Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes was signed by Gamble and Huff, mm-hmm, of Philadelphia International Records. What do you think was unique about their approach to production? And maybe another way I should put it first is, what changed about the sound of the group once you were part of Philadelphia International?
Well, I think when they came to see us at the Apollo Club in Camden, New Jersey, in 1970, what they heard was a group with a lot of dimension. They saw a group with a lot of class, a lot of savvy, a lot of experience. If nothing else, Harold was a taskmaster, and he was extremely knowledgeable about show business and how we should perform, what we should look like as a unit, how you should do things together. The choreography was like one person was dancing. I mean, we truly could work the gamut because we had to. We had to work in front of little white ladies with blue hair in Miami Beach, and we had to work in front of pimps and hustlers and prostitutes in New York or Buffalo or wherever we were. So we had to really know what we were doing in order to continue to work, because we were working because of our reputation. We had no records.
I want to play one of your really big hits during the Philadelphia International era with Harold Melvin and
Please
the Blue
do.
Notes. This is The Love I Lost. You say in your memoir that originally this was supposed to be a ballad, but then the tempo got picked up. What were the changes that this song went through during the production, and why did it go through them?
It's just once you're in the studio, magic happens, because you're in there with live musicians, and as you try different feels, you try things, and that's the ability that you have with live musicians that you don't have with computers.
This is The Love I Lost, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing me.
The love I lost. Hoping that you and I could make it all through, but something went wrong. We loved each other, we just couldn't get along. Take a good look at me, I'm in misery. Can't you see? The love
was a sweet love.
Yes, it was.
Love I Lost, one of the big hits of the 70s with my guest Teddy Pendergrass singing lead.
Oh, that was good. I haven't heard this song in a long time.
Did your fans realize that the lead voice they were hearing was the voice of Teddy Pendergrass and not Harold Melvin? Because the group is called Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and you would assume that right. He was the lead singer.
Right. Well, my friends knew, but nobody else knew. And that was what really got me after a while. So, a lot of times...
Do people not believe you sometimes? You say, but that's me singing lead, did they say?
Not my I didn't really tell anybody.
Oh.
I'm not one like that. But however, in clubs and places we would work, and they would come to me and go, oh, that was a great show, Harold. And I'd say, I'm not Harold, that's Harold. And people would just kind of look like, huh? You know, I guess they thought I was on dope dog food or something because I wasn't acknowledging that I was who they just knew I was. And that was quite different. And it got to a point on our third album that I demanded that my name be put on the record. I was tired of being called Harold and I wanted my just dues.
After you went on your own, you eventually started doing, in addition to your regular concerts, you started doing for women only shows. What was the difference between what you did on stage or what you sang in the For Women Only shows than the rest of your concerts?
The difference was they were probably a little more provocative. I probably played to the audience a lot more because they were all female. And subtle differences like that.
What impact did it have on your ego and your personal life to be a romantic icon?
Did it have and does it have? Or did it because it's not over.
So my impression, though, is that your ego is in a different place now than it was before. My impression just from things that you've said is that you felt that your ego at times was a little out of control earlier, mm-hmm. and that's
it was all
no
new.
Longer the case.
It was all new. All new. And when you get that kind of adulation and people are just at your beck and call and at your feet, giving you what you want. I was a young kid, I was 26 years old, 27 years old. 20, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It can alter your thinking from it. Sometimes your head is too big to get through a door. And mine got there. I was able to, you know, bring things back into perspective. But, yeah, it can alter your ego. It can give you a nice big one. I mean, at 28 years old, I mean, I was buying a 34-room mansion in Gladwin. It's kind of, you know, coming from a row house in North Philadelphia and buying my mother a home a mile and a half away and filling up a garage with Rolls Royces and Ferraris. I mean, I don't know a whole lot of people that do that.
Right.
So I guess it is kind of people that live what you call quote-unquote normal life to even begin to understand that a I guess, you know, normally you work through a job and you work up and you get a raise, and the more you work, the older you get, the more money you make, and if you're able to get those kind of things, it's later on in life, not at 28 or so.
Teddy Pendergrass speaking to Terry Gross in 1998. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1998 interview with Teddy Pendergrass, the Philadelphia soul singer who died Wednesday at age 59. He was a romantic icon in 1982 when he had his car accident that left him a quadriplegic. Terry asked him about the accident.
It took me years to be able to drive by the accident site. So that was the point that changed my life. That's where the old Teddy died and the new guy was born. So I don't live it. I don't discuss it. I just kind of move on.
I know after the accident, you went through a very deep period of depression. And you write in your book about an experience you had with a family therapist named Dr. Dan Gottlieb, who everyone at the radio station where I work, WHYY, knows because he does a show here about families. And he also was in a car accident and is also...
Same level quadriplegia.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you said it was really useful to talk with a therapist who really understood what you were going through.
Mm-hmm.
He suggested during one of your bad depressions that you kind of stage a mock funeral.
Mm-hmm.
What did he suggest that you do? I mean, you actually did it. What was that experience?
It was the turning point for me. When you have gone through something as traumatic as I have, and other people have like me, you have a lot of concerns about what are you going to do with your life and where's it going to go from here. Unfortunately, my drop was in front of the world. It wasn't a guy, Joe Blow, that had a car accident. This was Teddy Pendergrass, quote unquote, sex, same thing you said, sex symbol, da 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 da, had a car accident. What's going to happen? Where is he going? It was these big questions. And I played into those questions because I was concerned about those same issues. So when people started writing those things in newspapers, like I say in my book, there's a certain reporter that really asked the question, who will be the next Teddy Pendergrass? And he named out all of these potential artists. And I read that and I went, oh my God. You know, that really, really does hurt. So the mock funeral was a turning point for me by covering myself up or being covered up with a white sheet and having friends and family come and give me their final words as though I was dead in a casket was what that's about. Because Dr. Gottlieb felt that there was nothing really he could say. I was in such a deep depression.
So what impact did it have on you when you were sitting there under the white sheet listening to everybody speaking about your life?
I wasn't ready for that. I was not ready to be in a funeral, in a casket. Suddenly became a non-option. Killing myself was a no-no.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but from your memoir, I get the sense that after your accident, when you had to kind of recreate your life, that you had to kind of figure out what parts of you were like a performing persona and what parts of you were who you really were. Am I misinterpreting?
Yeah, I kind of had to put everything into the right perspective. Yeah.
So, do you feel that you think of yourself any differently now than you did before the accident in terms of like the essence of who you are?
I think that the content of my character is much different than it was. I think now that I'm much more of a whole individual than I was 16 years ago. I see now that I have the the audacity to move through this and make something of myself irrespective. You know what I'm saying, trying mm-hmm. to say? Rather, I'm not going to let this keep me from being the person I know I can be and that I have proven to myself that I can be. With that, it really does make me feel that life is still enjoyable.
Teddy Pendergrass, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Teddy Pendergrass speaking to Terry Gross in 1998, 12 years after the accident that left him a quadriplegic. The Philadelphia soul singer died Wednesday at age 59. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.